Hello, everyone, and welcome to myself, Max McGillivray of Beanstalk. We are very proud to be running this one-off broadcast about Brexit. This year, we have run some 50 webinars and broadcasts on various subjects on a UK and international perspective. But we've had a number of calls to set up a Brexit broadcast because, well, it's not that we know exactly what is going on in much detail at this point in time that we'll come on to. But as we all know, there's been a lot of a huge amount of conversation from politicians and journalists talking about this this subject. What we were really keen to do with Beanstalk was to get some experts on the ground, so to speak, so that we could get their opinion as to where we are and where we're going to be, rather than perhaps listening to slightly monosyllabic politicians or journalists asking those politicians those questions. So just quickly, let's do the advertorial for Beanstalk. If you're not aware of us, we set ourselves up as a communication platform to encourage more fresh food, more fresh produce consumption in the UK and internationally. We started off by the series of webinars and broadcasts, as well as one-to-one interviews. And if you watch out next year, we've got some great, exciting things to inform you about as to how we're going to get more people to enjoy and consume fresh produce and fresh food on an international basis. We're really looking to make a difference. We want to create the conversation around fresh produce, fresh food, and not be part of it. To do that, we've got two key routes. We've got our trade connections, and we've also got our consumer connections, which are very significant both ways. And also, what we've really enjoyed this year is the partnerships that we've created with the likes of Global Women Fresh, looking to encourage more women to come into agriculture and fresh produce from the farm, from the field, all the way through to board level. They have introduced us through to ITC, International Trade Center, and She Trades. And we did a great continental broadcast last week. I think we were across five continents. We've also set up key relationships with the likes of the United Fresh organization in the States. And we've got more yet to come with some key South African players next year, but watch this space. So thank you very much to our sponsors, who we would not be able to have got to this point in time if it wasn't for their assistance and actually their faith in what we've done to date and what we're looking to create. So let's get into this. So Brexit. So where are we? Stumbling blocks remain, says Michael Barnier. He's the EU chief negotiator. Talks in Brussels are continuing with 2 weeks to go before the UK leaves EU trading rules. Earlier today, Michael Gove said the UK government would do everything to secure a deal with the EU. He also told MPs that they could be called upon from their Christmas break to approve a deal if one was agreed. But leaders from the EU Parliament said they would not be rushed into approving the deal their end. And we would have to see the text of any agreement by this Sunday, if they were to sign it off by the end of the year. The UK left the EU on the 31st of January of this year, but has remained under many of its rules while the two sides negotiate a trade deal. If an agreement is not reached by the end of this year, by the 31st of December, the UK will have to trade with the EU on World Trade Organizational rules, meaning taxes on goods being bought and sold between the two may be introduced and would lead to higher prices. So what are the basics? Brexit happened, but rules didn't change at once. The UK left the EU on the 31st of Jan, but leaders needed time to negotiate a deal for life afterwards. They got 11 months. They got 11 months. We've got 2 weeks to go. Talks are still happening. The UK and the EU have until the 31st of December 2020 to agree a trade deal, as well as other things such as fishing rights. If there's no deal, border checks and taxes will be introduced for goods traveling between the UK and the EU. But deal or no deal, we will still see changes. So let's get everyone in. So everyone, can you turn on your videos? And what we're going to do is we're just going to get everyone to introduce themselves just briefly. And then I'm going to go to each of our panelists just to give a bit of background as to what they're seeing at the moment in the context of Brexit. And then after that, we're going to go into a Q&A session. So please, if you have questions of our experts, please use Zoom. You know how to do it on the bottom toolbar to ask those questions of them. And then I will bat them around accordingly so that we can get the best from everyone. So we're going to run for about about an hour or so. We're going to keep the pace pretty lively because it's a pretty lively subject. So let's find out who we've got on. So Joe, let's start from you. Joe, who are you, please?
Afternoon, everyone. I'm Joe. I head up the produce team at Kantar UK. For those of you who aren't familiar with Kantar, we basically operate a mini population of the UK and track everything that they buy. So we're helping food manufacturers and retailers understand how to sell more fresh produce, how to improve relationships between each other, theoretically, and provide knowledge to the wider industry, which is what I'm here to do today.
Joe, thank you. And Joe's been brilliant at some of the other broadcasts that we've had him on, as you'll find out, because Joe's going to run through some slides as to the context of this conversation. If you want to find out about what is going on within fresh produce or and specific sectors, you need to speak to Joe and the and his team. Emily, over to you, please. Who are you and who are Savills?
Oh, okay. Emily Norton, head of rural research at Savills, partner in a family farming business in Norfolk. Spend a lot of time talking to farmers, land managers, institutional owners, investors about what's going on in the land management sector.
And Emily, I've got to ask, are you confident about the future?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. Particularly in an environment where a lot of people are feeling quite sceptical and dislike change. What I like to see is there's an awful lot of new entrants still waiting to get into our industry who want their chance to make a difference. And I think, you know, from that alone, we take a lot of positivity.
Yeah, but we'll probably talk about it. But bizarrely, this whole thing about COVID, it's made people more interested in food and agriculture. So if it actually creates a boom of younger individuals coming into the sector, it's going to be beneficial for us for us all. Andy, moving over to you, just as we were talking in the green room, I slightly described you as our very positive joker in the pack. With Andy, we're really keen to introduce him, his colleagues and his business into the fresh food, fresh produce and ag sectors. As Andy will describe, he's done a lot within meat. I think what Andy's offering, what he has got for our sector is going to be very, very positive, because I believe what his offer is very fragmented within fresh produce within the UK and internationally. So Andy, I've put the ball between the posts. You've got the wind behind you. Go on, kick it through.
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity, and thank you to refer to me as the new or the boy. I'm not sure which one I prefer more. The company, FSIS, I've been in around trade credit insurance, which is all around transactional risk, for more than 30 years. And what we've done is we've worked a lot with sectors where there's traditionally high volume, low margin and high risk. And what we've done within the meat sector is identified where the risk sits, both in the transaction and the end debtor. And then what we've done over a period of time, we've managed to reduce the level of insolvency. So helping companies to trade, to make the right risk decisions, and to maximise profit. And we're excited to now be part of the fruit and veg sector, because we'd like to replicate all the positive steps and services and products we've introduced in the meat to the fruit and veg. And therefore, we believe you guys will benefit from that.
Andy, fantastic. And then last but not least, we've got the two poster boys of fresh produce. Who should we go for first? Well, let's pick on Tim. Tim O'Malley, who are you? Like the world doesn't know.
Poster boy, Maxi, thank you. Tim O'Malley, Group Managing Director, Nationwide Produce PLC. What do? We do everything in fresh produce. We grow it, we grade it, we pack it, we trade it, we import, we export. But probably above all, what we do is we import. We've got offices and businesses and depots in Belfast, two in Holland, one in Spain, six around the UK mainland. But yeah, the main thing we do is import. So I'm all over Brexit like a cheap too.
It's fascinating speaking to Tim as to how often you guys have been having your internal Brexit meetings. Tim, has that accelerated? Are you literally every day having a meeting internally about Brexit?
I just come off one now, actually. So we've been having them every week for the last couple of months, and then we're stepping them up to two or three a week. Just come off one today, next one on Tuesday. Yeah, it's a big part of what we do. So we're trying to plan and be as prepared as possible.
Tim, just out of curiosity, you didn't listen to the webinar with the government this morning at 10:30, did you?
Yes. Which one?
With the one I was on, I had to bail out after half an hour because the sound quality was so bad. And I just couldn't hear the delivery of what they were saying. But I suppose that's just the issue of the modern communications that we have at the moment.
Yeah.
So last but not least, our final poster boy of the fresh produce sector, Jack, please tell everyone who you are.
Max, you're too kind. Jack Ward, and I head up the British Growers Association. British Growers is an organisation of organisations. So we've got about 26, 27 organisations that operate across the fresh produce sector and very much in the production end of fresh produce, dealing with both fruit and vegetables.
Fantastic, Jack. Thank you. So let's move over to Joe. Joe, I have switched on your screen sharing, so we won't make the normal mistake I make. So we'll start with Joe, and remember everyone listening in, questions. If you've got questions of our experts, please fire them in. And we'll start this round robin and just get everyone's views to where we see Brexit at the moment and where it's going to be. Everyone, apart from Joe, can we just turn off our videos so that we can all see Joe's screen properly? Thank you. Joe, over to you.
Good stuff. I take it you can all see this. So when it comes to measuring the impact of Brexit, obviously there are so many complexities, the logistics, et cetera. Kantar is really not well geared up towards to looking at that. However, what we are able to do really effectively is look at the impacts on consumers when there have been similar, although you can argue there haven't been any similar one-off shocks in the industry, such as previous recessions, the financial crisis, coronavirus response, etc. And I think what's really important to understand is that although we could be facing some sort of official recession, some sort of immediate short-term impact from Brexit, there is a consumer reaction that goes on far longer than that. So while in the Great Recession we saw an official impact of 15 months, the consumer recession, where consumers were managing their spend very closely, belt tightening in lots of areas, lasted about 6 years. This is what we've been saying since March when the coronavirus hit. We have now the added complexity of Brexit, which introduces higher inflation into the mix, which will no doubt have a strong consumer reaction. When we do talk about inflation, though, generally people don't stop buying fewer groceries. They carry on buying the same number, if not more than they did, and look to make savings in the sort of higher spend discretionary items like holidays, meals out, that sort of thing, entertainment and leisure. So historically, if you look at this chart, we have weathered inflation pretty well. And as we were discussing prior to this meeting kicking off, sometimes it is the deflation and bringing prices down to such an extremely low level that has a real negative impact in the market, as we can see from 2013 to 2016. So what this doesn't capture, importantly, is the supply shortages expected from a no deal Brexit. And generally, when we look at one-off economic shocks, there are four levers that shoppers can pull to retain their spend, to manage their spend and just tighten their belts a bit. First is buy less stuff. It's not very attractive buying fewer groceries. We all need to feed ourselves, and I very much doubt that extra volume is going to come from the out-of-home sector. We could shop in cheaper stores, as lots of people traded down to the German discounters after the impact of the Great Recession. Or at that particular time, we could buy more on deal or choose cheaper products, which were the number one and two drivers of shoppers saving money during the last recession. Now, I suppose what this doesn't capture is the extremely different pattern that we'll see if short-term supply issues arise. So things will be different. And probably the most significant thing will be we will be buying less stuff if there are supply issues, and probably because the prices will rise as well. Promotions conceivably won't be as big of a thing at all. Arguably the least significant lever shoppers will be able to pull if we come out with no deal. We probably won't be shopping in cheaper stores in the short term anyway. Store loyalty has grown since coronavirus kicked in, and it's very unlikely that we're going to be hopping around stores while there's a health risk. As well, we're probably not going to be choosing cheaper products because the products are going to be inherently more expensive when the inflation kicks in. So these are all short-term things that make forecasting the reaction extremely difficult. I think it's probably pertinent to look at how this will play out long-term as well, if we all accept that there will be some measure of inflation in this sector affecting different categories. And once supply issues are addressed, the long-term inflation in fresh produce could conceivably create a scenario like the last consumer recession, where if we go from left to right, we saw an increase in spend per household from 2015 from 2007 to 2015 of 22%. That would have been 36% had it not been for shoppers managing their spend in various ways. So we bought more volume, but we coped with buying more volume by shopping in cheaper stores, but most importantly, buying more on deal when brands ramped up promotions and choosing cheaper products. which is now far more permissible when we have things like the farm brands and generally more attractive looking own label options in that value tier. So we could see a similar pattern this time round. And it will be buying more on promotion and choosing cheaper products almost definitely that will drive that consumer saving. Promotions are still at an all-time low and that value tier is extremely permissible nowadays. And I think ending on a positive note though, as I would always like to do during these sort of talks about big shocks and how they would impact consumers. When we look at the consumer recession and growth in produce over that time period in the black boxes here, what we can see is that during the initial shock or the aftermath of the initial shock, every core produce sector outperformed the consumer spend over that kind of consumer recession time period. So while there's going to be some short-term impacts and inflation, and that's going to be really difficult to manage, awful logistically, actually, when we look at supermarket sales, this isn't a sector that shoppers are going to stop buying. There may be some teething issues, but it's well positioned to weather the storm in a long-term kind of environment of shoppers looking to manage their spend. So hopefully that leaves you with some positivity, and it will be very interesting to see how this all plays out. So do get in touch if you have concerns about your individual categories out there, and I'll do my very best to help you through it by gazing into my crystal ball.
Joe, well done, that was brilliant. If everyone else come back in, please. Joe, with your comment that we will still see consumers going into store, why is there a need to, I'm going to have to put you on the spot on this one, Joe, why do you think there's a need for retailers to do such deep discounting? And it's not just in the UK, as we said in the green room, we've seen the same in the States when I was on a Zoom call with United Fresh yesterday. So we've had reports this morning from the likes of Audi, deep discounting the likes of potatoes from 70p I think it's 250 grams to 14p and a whole range of a slew of other deep discounts. Do you think there's any benefit for the retailers to create these deep discounts on the run up to Christmas when surely the consumer wants those products? Why are they sort of cutting their own risk when it's potentially not to their gain? Why do you think, Joe?
I honestly think it's a drug that they're hooked on and nobody wants to get off it for fear of losing market share at Christmas. No doubt it looks really good when you go into store having lots of deals on fresh produce. That can be quite exciting and alluring, but there is no actual tangible benefit in the data that it impacts wider store performance in a positive way. It does not have the same positive halo effect that the M&S meal deal has or had on consumers' overall spend in that store, or that deep cut booze deals have when it's hot and we want to get out and buy lots of beer. So it's really difficult to see the benefit, to be honest.
So there's the whole PhD to be done and the psychology of retail buying, that they are perhaps a bit like sheep, that if one does it, they all feel the need to, when there's actually no benefit for it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I suppose it's difficult on the one hand, because now this year people are under a lot of economic hardship and it could be seen as good to offer cheap fresh produce. And I guess, yeah, politically and ethically, maybe a bit dubious if someone was to pull out of that. It might look bad from a PR perspective, but I do think it's a drug that somebody needs to wean them off soon enough.
And everyone, if you want to see Joe's slides again, this broadcast will be available as a full recording on YouTube within the next 12, 24 hours. So you'll be able to scroll back. And as Joe says, if you need any assistance from him looking in his crystal balls, get in contact with him either through us or via Joe on LinkedIn. Emily, so farming, Savills. Now, Savills has got a huge reach in the UK and also internationally. And I suppose I've got to apologise slightly for my pointed question right from the start as to whether you're positive about the future. Emily, what are you seeing in terms of farming within the UK now, Brexit, and then 2021 beyond?
Well, we'll keep this focus sort of more or less on food and fresh produce, I think. And I think one of the key things that we're seeing at policy level is the differentiation between the way that the Scots, the Welsh and the English are doing, you know, Northern Ireland aside at the moment. The Welsh yesterday announced their new sort of guidelines for what's going to happen in Welsh food and farming after Brexit. And it focuses on food, which is amazing. So this idea of sustainable food production. And it is the opposite to the situation that we're getting in England, where all of the agricultural policy is focused on the environment and food is this thing that the market has to cope with. So if you are in a fresh produce supply chain, or if you are in a situation where you are growing any kind of produce, which is going to go into a manufacturing sector, agri-food sector within England, and then the situation is quite different and the market rules might be very different from that perspective.
And Emily, one term I've always used in all of these broadcasts is that the government has always stated that we are but four missed meals from anarchy. So if the consumer and Brexit create, if Brexit creates a situation where we can't have meals on the table, do you think we might actually have a social, economical and political issue come January 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th?
And of course, I mean, didn't coronavirus show us that actually, you know, the whole debate around the future of agricultural support in this country and how what happened with coronavirus in March really helped to highlight that food security is a real thing. It's not a theoretical thing. Actually needing to get food onto shelves is a problem. What I thought was really interesting in the government's messaging was saying that supermarkets are feeding the country. And it was very much this sort of shift of responsibility onto the functioning of supply chains to say that, you know, food security is not a government concern. Government is not feeding the country. Government is not making sure that this stuff happens. Supermarkets are feeding the country and it's up to them to make sure that the food is reallocated and got to the people who need it.
So do you think, Emily, that's because they want to pass the buck in case there is a train crash?
I'm not sure. I mean, if there's a train crash, the buck has to stop somewhere and ultimately it will stop with government and government policy. But I do think it's a little bit glib for, you know, just the collective self-interest, I think, is the best way to describe supply chains that they work. They're all interacting. It's massively complicated and things and people elbowing up against each other and, you know, each trying to sort of act in your own best interest in securing that produce to make sure you've got it to be able to sell to consumers. You know, how that evolves over the next 2 months, 1 month, versus how it's going to evolve over 5 years. The risk is back on supply chains to make sure that those retailers have got the produce to be able to stock. And I think that's the really important thing to reiterate at the moment. It's changing not just as a result of coronavirus and Brexit, but fundamentally because of that policy change, which says, you know, if you want to source it, farmers aren't just going to grow it. They're not going to take a risk on it unless you invest in the grower supply place to say, yeah, we need you to grow this for us.
Yeah, Emily, well done. Andy, can you believe that you run a very well established business? 4 years ago, when the referendum went the way it did, could you believe that we were going to be in this situation, that 2 weeks before we were due to leave, we still haven't got everything sorted? Could you believe it?
Simple answer is I've dabbled in politics, and simple answer to that is yes, I can believe it. But what's also interesting for me, you know, you described me as the new boy, which I am. And I looked at and spoke to quite a few people in the fruit and veg. And the obvious remark is how important fresh fruit and veg is to the UK consumer. And the conclusion that I've come to is that, one, we're not ready. So even if there is a deal done on the 31st, even though we get it through Parliament, then we get it through the EU, there's still some fundamental challenges and additional costs. So what amazes me is when people talk about Brexit and suddenly if we do a deal, everything's okay. No, it's not. There's additional charges, there's additional processes, additional customs, additional certificates needed. And with all that, all I'm seeing is a lot of the retailers squeezing the price down, margins reducing. And I think what we're going to have is what I would describe as a perfect storm. Yeah, and I think what's going to happen is that level of insolvencies, not just in the fruit and veg, is 24% lower than it was this time last year. So it's artificially low. But we're predicting in the credit insurance market that that could increase to 51%. So we're going to see more pressure on margins, more costs. And obviously what we have seen in an artificial way is that a lot of companies have got government support schemes. The court system isn't open until the 21st of March. So all we're doing at the moment is kicking the can down the road. And some of the phrases that we've been using is there's going to be a tsunami of claims and challenges. The fruit and veg sector, from a risk, I'm an underwriter, so looking at the dynamics of the business and the margins and how it trades, I'm not sure in certain parts of, I mean, let's go back one step. 60% of fresh fruit and veg is through the retail sector. 40% is non-retail, as I understand it. So your cash, your hospitality, and people and so forth. All I see is margins being squeezed. All I see is level of debt increasing. And all I see is more pressure on the fruit and veg sector. And I see it across the board generally within the food sector. So unless companies start to think about the consequences of low margins, how it affects their bottom line, the ability to raise working capital, yeah, the recovery, hopefully the hospitality sector. If you put it into perspective, Max, if someone on 5% margins, which is maybe quite generous for some fruit and veg, you lose £50,000 and one of your customers doesn't pay you, you've got to generate an additional £1 million of non-risk wow. income to replace that loss. So part of this discussion is very much about Brexit and what you need from a transport, from a customs. But what companies have to look at is profit erosion, risk, and what we call a de-risk model. So what happens, for example, if sterling deflates by 5%? Then you've got increased costs. Then you've got pressure from the retailer. So you're going to have all these companies in the middle that's going to be squeezed. And then when we talk to some of the retailers, the impression we get is that they're not going to carry those additional costs. They suspect the supplier. So margins have become even more under pressure. So I think if we're not too careful, I think part of the lack of supply will really be down to companies saying, I've had enough and I'm not going to trade anymore. Yeah. And when you look at the banks, when the banks look at funding, they'll look at margins as part of their criteria. If the margins are not there, we're going to find some of these companies unable to get working capital. So I see Brexit as part of the problem, but I'm going to say that I think margins and low margins is probably a bigger risk to the industry than potentially Brexit.
Well, and Andy, where that's fascinating is the conversation I was involved with yesterday with United Fresh on a Zoom call to a number of produce companies on the eastern side of the States, that it feels like they're 3 months in advance of us, because the retailers there are looking to stock their stores with more fresh produce and less high value items, but they want the grower and the marketeer to have even further eroded margins. So it's going to be fascinating to see how that pans out. Jack, thoughts, please.
I couldn't agree with Andy more. This issue of low margins, absolutely critical. And as he says, I think probably this is a much bigger issue for UK growers than Brexit. This question of margin, has been ongoing for several years. And actually, we've seen a really good example of what we're talking about in the last couple of days with these massive discounts that are being applied to seasonal vegetables in the run-up to Christmas. We've seen adverts where the conventional price of things like carrots and parsnips and potatoes has been cut by half. And then you see the discounters cutting the margins even further. And I think one of the issues is it gives the consumers a very false perspective of actually what it costs to produce food. And I think if we look to the future, we're all about zero carbon. We're all about doing things in a more environmentally sensitive way. There are going to be real issues around the use of crop protection products over the next 10 years. And the only one thing you can conclude is actually the cost of producing food is going to get more expensive. And I think as a society, we're just going to have to have a grown-up conversation about what it costs to produce food. How much should we realistically be paying for food? And is this constant erosion of food prices in everybody's interest in the long term? Can we actually deliver what everybody is looking for from UK agriculture, from global agriculture, with margins down at 1% or below?
Jack, thank you. Tim, you and I, over the last 10 years, have done multiple interviews together where we've gone round and round this subject. Tim, you have the floor.
It's interesting to see what Andy said there, from somebody from outside the industry. He's obviously just done a bit of research on it and picking up on that fact straight away. As a numbers guy, as an underwriter, The only thing I would say is that when you use the example of 5%, that's a bit pissed. You should halve that, really. It should be about 2-2.5% net margin that we work on. The risk to reward factor that we work on in this industry is barking. And it's simple, really. What happens, it drives production abroad. And that's what we're seeing. So 67% of fresh produce consumed in the UK is imported, about 6 million tonne from over 95 countries, with about a third of that coming from the EU. And that's going one way. That's going up. And it's all about risk to reward factor for growers. The amount of there's some seriously big growers out there contemplating just packing it in the UK and moving production over to Poland and particularly to Eastern Europe. Because they've basically got better things to do with the time and the money. It's ridiculous, the margins we're working on. And now we've got Brexit coming in, and it's just going to increase costs. There's a lot of talk about deal or no deal, but what we're overlooking here is whether there's a deal or there's no deal, we've still got this massive tranche of extra paperwork. Well, all the deal does is reduce part of that paperwork, and that's the duty, yeah? So what a deal, the main thing a deal will do is give us some clarity on whether we've got a duty or not, hopefully not. But we've still got this, as I well know, because we're big importers, this massive tranche of paperwork still to do. Deal or no deal, we've still got CMLs, packing lists, phytosanitary certificates. We've still got a raft of things that we don't do at the moment that we need to do, that we need to have a customs clearance agent involved. And the cost for it, just to be clear, because we just had some costs from our, the biggest trucking company from Holland, Daily Fresh, who do all our goods from Holland over to the UK. They just told us that it's going to be per consignment for the paperwork, for the customs clearance, €90 best case scenario, €149.50 worst case scenario. Now, best case scenario is if you've got a direct link to their system that you can data transfer all the extra information that's needed, and there is a shed load of extra information that's needed, direct into their system, and then they can produce all that paperwork in order to get the goods over. That's your best case scenario. So if you've got a good enough system that you can do that, that's fine. Unfortunately, in our relatively backward IT industry, not many people have. So that's the best case scenario, €90. The worst case is if you're doing it, you expect them to input it all manually. And then there's also a requirement for a phytosanitary certificate. That's about €150. So for those smaller companies, and particularly in the hard hit hospitality sector, who we're used to at the moment, simply being able to, I mean, ordering from Holland at the moment is like ordering from Scotland. You know, you can, they've got better transport. You know, we often say this, there's better transport coverage from Rotterdam than there is from anywhere in the UK. You can get from Rotterdam to a postcode in the UK. So we've had this luxury for years of being able to pick up the phone to somebody in Holland, whether it be one of our companies or whoever, and day one for day two, being able to get a pallet of tomatoes or a mixed pallet of tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, or whatever. It's now going to be day one for day three, because the other thing that's coming in, with all this extra paperwork that's involved, the hauliers are saying there's no way we're going to be able to do day one for day two. We're going to be day one for day three. And then there's also the extra cost. So we reckon that those smaller wholesalers and food service companies who order less than about 5 pallets at a time, they're probably going to be better off ordering it from going back to the old system of depots in the UK. Whereas, you know, if you went back 30 years ago, most imported produce was bought into centralized depots and then distributed out. Again, it was because of the complexity of importing that, and the cost of importing, that you get importers. Remember them specific importers with warehouses in the UK who bring the product in. And if you only wanted one pallet, or 2 pallets or 3 pallets for day one for day two, you pick up the phone to them and they deliver it to you. We're going back to that. It's such a massive, massive retrograde step. I mean, I remember doing this 30 years ago and we got rid of all that. And we were going, we're now day one for day two, A to B. It's going to be day one for day two, A to B to C. We're going to have nothing on, we're going to go from nothing on documents to up to €150 on docs, yeah? I can't begin to tell you the amount of disruption that this will cause. And I cannot see this country being prepared for it, certainly for the first couple of weeks of Jan.
Tim, do you think this is going to be a short-term issue, or is this going to be here for the long-term?
I think it's going to be long-term. I think, you know, not so much as supermarkets. Again, they seem to be coming out of this the best of everybody, but yep. The hospitality sector, definitely, because, you know, there's these smaller regional food service wholesale companies. We just said that hospitality represents about 30% of the food we consume. And there's these smaller regional food service companies who just are used to day one for day two, and they can't afford to pay this extra €150 a pallet, you know, or for two pallets. So they'll end up buying it from local depots, local wholesalers. It is genuinely like turning the clock back about 30 years in terms of that sector of the market. So it's definitely going to drive cost in. And I think what the retailers will do, that the cost of the customs clearance cost that I was mentioning there, they'll just tell the packers that you've got to swallow that, like you've got to swallow everything else. So another erosion of margin for the packers.
Jack, do you think that Tim is a lone voice, or is he speaking for the industry?
No, I think he's absolutely spot on. I don't think we've begun to contemplate just how complicated we have made the system. You know, we've turned what is a seamless system into something that's incredibly complicated. And I know what I've seen over the past sort of 6 weeks is a sort of frantic panic to try and get as much stuff on our side of the channel as we possibly can. Things like seeds, we import a lot of seeds for vegetables from various parts of the EU. There's been a real scramble to try and make sure that seed is in the UK before the 31st. Plants, things like apple trees, strawberry plants. You know, I don't think we've just begun to understand at all how difficult it's going to be. And actually, you know, and even within the UK, when you start looking at the situation with Northern Ireland and how you move stuff from the mainland across to Northern Ireland, I've been talking to a company that does mushroom compost, and they supply mushroom compost to Northern Ireland. And, you know, the arrangements to enable that to continue on the 1st of January still are not in place.
God. Emily, are you seeing the same thing? I'm just thinking that myself, you and Joe seem to be the more positive out of everyone here, but we need to be realistic that it does sound...
Somebody described me the other day as a pragmatic optimist, you know, and maybe that's the thing, you know, it is a question of business finding a way. And undoubtedly, all of these frictions, all of these problems are just things that need to be solved, and business will find a way of solving them again, and the processes will be created. But it's incredibly easy for me to say that, because it's not my job to try and sort it out. You know, for you guys on the front line, I can see how it's incredibly disruptive and really quite frustrating. So, you know, there's not a lot more that can be said. Of course, change is always going to be difficult.
Andy, Tim, do you think there will be solutions? Do you think the likes of Nationwide Produce and businesses like yourself, Tim, will come up with solutions?
Do you know what concerns me at the moment? We're already getting stuck, falling through the cracks. I mean, we've got a real concern about, Jack will probably know about this. From the 1st of January, our one true success story on export is banned. Yeah. So in this country, as I said, we import 67% of our fruit and veg, and it equates to about £5 billion worth and rising. Yeah. We export nothing. We export next to nothing. We are pitiful on exporting. And OAHDB are talking about doing a lot of work about trying to get us to export more. And the irony of that is that, so by comparison to the 5 billion and rising that we import, we export 200 to 250 million. And do you know what? Amongst that poxy 200 to 250 million, there's one shining product that we export week in, week out, and it's the only one, and it's potatoes to Ireland. And a lot of people will be surprised at that, exporting spuds to Ireland. It seems like coal to Newcastle, sand to the Arrows, whatever you want to call it. But it's because our Fenland potatoes produce a particularly good chip, and the Irish are very fussy about the chips, and they love our Fenland potatoes. Not just the Fenland potatoes, other potatoes as well, but we export week in, week out, not just us, but a lot of people, week in, week out, potatoes to Ireland. We export about 100,000 tonne of worm potatoes to the Republic of Ireland every year, and about 40,000 tonne to Northern Ireland, which equates to about 112 full lorry loads a week. Yeah. Now, from the 1st of January, that is banned. because potatoes are on the high priority plants list. So they need something called third country equivalence. Now, there's some confusion out there that we're going to need a phyto to export potatoes. It's not even that. They're banned. Potatoes will be banned from export to Ireland, our only shining success story. And the government seem to be doing very little about it. At the moment, it's not solved. And and just to make matters worse, the potato job this year is absolutely on its backside. Because we had so much disruption last year with the whole food service industry being knocked out. There's a bit of an oversupply this year, and the spot potato market is terrible. And then we're about to take away the export market. And then the other one, you mentioned seed potatoes. I mean, that one's even more barking. That gets tied up with potatoes as well. But it's not just people get through. It's not just Ireland, it's Northern Ireland. Because there's no border, between Ireland and Northern Ireland, effectively no border, it's one, let me get this word right, epidemiological area. So it's counted as one from a plant health point of view. So we can't export potatoes to Ireland or to our own Northern Ireland, despite the fact that we've got a burgeoning demand and it's one our one true success story. And seed potatoes, I mean, that one's even worse. That's a success story as well. We export a lot of seed potatoes, particularly from Scotland, over to Ireland and Northern Ireland. And apparently we've done a deal with the EU whereby they are allowed to still export their seed potatoes to the UK. So the Minister of Agriculture a few months ago, under pressure from the industry, said, because we import a lot of seed, particularly from Holland, seed potatoes from Holland. So we said, right, we'll allow you to bring them over here because we need them. And and there was a lot of pressure from the big freezing companies and the big crisping companies, because they lobbied the government and said, we tend to use Dutch seed, so we need you to get that exemption. So we got that exemption. So we're allowing seed potatoes to come in from the EU. But guess what? At the same time, we didn't get the same ban. So we're not allowed to, we're allowed to import seed potatoes from the EU, but we're not allowed to export any seed potatoes. It's absolutely barking. It drives me bonkers. It really does.
But Tim, are we not in but the middle of a storm that we need to work our way through? And yes, there's going to be pain and adversity, but if there's one thing that we've all learned about farming and fresh produce in the UK and internationally, that everyone normally comes up with a solution. It's just another challenge. There must be a solution.
I think the thing that concerns me more so about word potatoes and seed potatoes, I think the thing that concerns me on word potatoes is that if we skip a beat here, because it's not getting any spotlight at the moment, because it's very low priority, and I'm, you know, the longer the time goes on, it's looking like we are going to be banned from exporting potatoes, this 140,000 ton that we do, our one true success story, to Ireland and Northern Ireland from the 1st of January. Now, eventually, maybe the spotlight will get shone on it. And maybe if we're really lucky, within 2, 3, 4 weeks, that ban might be lifted. Yeah. In the meantime, because the job's overdone as well, you'll have the Dutch and Belgians and French all over that one like a rash. Yeah. Somebody's going to plug that gap. And they'll get in and plug that gap, and it'll have long-term irreparable damage for that industry.
Andy, with your background within meat, I'm just looking at the longer term. You look at the mass consolidation that's happened within the meat sector, and in some respects, the adversity that that sector has seen. Do you think there's comparisons that we can learn from the meat sector that can be deployed into the fresh produce sector?
I think there's a lot of similarities. I think certainly margins, the volume nature of the business, the high concentration of goods that go to the retailers. But they seem to be a little bit more sensitive to some of the risks associated. And they seem to be working more closely together than what I've seen so far in the fruit and veg. For example, you know, we talked about margins, we talk about the importance of fresh fruit, we talk about, you know, these organisations like the FPC. There needs to be more joined up within the industry, someone from outside the industry looking in. There's lots of good companies, lots of good advice, there's lots of people with lots of experience. I just wonder whether there is a need for more cooperative working together, because unless some of these issues are addressed, that there is some, and when I talk about consequences, I'm talking about long-term consequences for the industry. Yeah, some of the figures I've got, for example, as part of my research, you know, from the EU, we import 11.1 billion. We export, at the moment, 1.3 billion. It's a deficit of 10 billion. So we're allowing the EU, the government's allowing the EU to dictate our terms, yeah? They've got more to lose than we have. But the positive is that there seems to be a lot more communication. I think it's vital that the hospitality comes back. I think the margins issue has to be addressed. I think there has to be more cooperation in the market. And I've been through recessions, yeah? I know you're thinking I look quite young to be going through three recessions, but this one's a different. The whole dynamics of this recession, which we will enter into in the next couple of years, is different. And I think part of the problem is about UK consumer confidence, but I think the recession in part could be due to lack of products in the marketplace. So it's going to be about the demand for the product, not the lack of demand for the product. So unless we start to address some of these issues, I have some concerns about this sector. And that would be reflected on rates as well.
Jack, views?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a UK perspective, you know, the majority of our product is going direct to the UK. You know, as Tim has said, the proportion of fresh produce that's exported is very small. Now, for those companies that are involved in exporting, that is probably a significant part of their business, and we shouldn't overlook that fact. But the bulk of the product that we produce here in the UK is destined for the UK market. There has been massive amounts of consolidation in fresh produce production. It's going to be interesting because I suspect that the rest of agriculture, and I'm sure Emily's got a view on this, is going to follow suit very, very quickly. That without that ability to rely on the basic payment scheme, you know, there is going to be some major restructuring within the agricultural industry, with a wider agricultural industry. But, you know, we have got some very sophisticated businesses, some very good businesses here in the UK, you know, and the opportunity still to supply the UK market is there. But, you know, let's be honest. For the past 40 years, we've been able to move freely across Europe. We've been able to trade freely across Europe. And on the 31st of December, that all comes to an end.
Emily, Jack has sort of thrown you the hospital pass, the baton. Views, please.
Well, I wrote an article this morning, which I was then told was too opinionated, so I wasn't allowed to publish it any further. So I can say now, because nobody's listening, are they? The point about that is, you know, we've had agricultural policy, land use policy in this country, which is focused on the economic sustainability of the supply base. OK, so everybody who is growing, everybody who is producing food within the United Kingdom and actually across the EU, of course, has had money coming into their businesses for the purpose of delivering economic sustainability. You know, it's essentially income support. There's been weak environmental conditionality attached to it. Now, in England, at least, that is going. We know over the course of 7 years, it's going to be gone completely. And all of the money is then going to be focused on environmental sustainability, effectively. And so it's only going to be propping up payments for watercourses and hedgerow management and all of the lovely things that we like to see to keep our, you know, countryside looking the way that it looks. So who's going to be focusing on economic sustainability of the producer base? And I don't think that, you know, at the moment, we're really aware of it. In these very dedicated supply chains, if it's a single product, meat, for example, or dairy or horticulture, it's much easier to see the beginning to end supply chain. And I think we need to get smarter. And I think legislation will come, and it's within the Agriculture Act, in order to regulate those supply chains to work better. And I'm not talking about the Groceries Code Adjudicator here. I'm talking about some fundamental definitions of what we mean by contractual fairness. It's something that we don't really talk about. You know, the French have sort of talked about it a bit. You know, we should be paying fairly for food. And I don't see at the moment that you can take away that economic sustainability focus and replace it with nothing and not expect major disruption in how we grow and produce food in this country. You have to replace it with something. And I think it will be replaced most likely by a lot tougher supply chain regulation. Whether that reflects what Andy's saying about collaboration, probably, you know, whether it begins to address some of these margin issues, almost definitely. You know, the way that we do it under our sort of free market notion of consumer driven, price focused being the only consideration, you know, is not the only way to organize a supply chain. And you can look for plentiful models globally of where things work better. But we've got to, I think, you know, the like you were saying earlier, the modern way, it's got to be pricing in carbon. It's got to be pricing in environmental degradation. We have to accept that we can't pay for food. We can't keep paying the price we pay for food at the moment unless the taxpayer picks up the consequences of that. And simply shifting it overseas is completely irresponsible. And I see the question there, you know, is really dedicated to that. It's saying, you know, how can we make sure that we continue to do this viably? It's got to be regulation.
Tim, your views of what Emily just said, and also just had a question in saying that if Tim is worried about the future, shouldn't Tim change his model? Shouldn't Tim change his business? So, Tim, your views on what Emily said first, please.
I am changing the model. We are changing the business. I mean, as I said, we've been meeting weekly, twice a week on Brexit. It's very high priority within our business. I'm just in the process of opening up a new company in Ireland. We've already got businesses registered in the two biggest exporting nations to the UK, which is Spain and Holland. And that puts us at a big advantage, potentially. But it just grates me, you know, some of the things that are going on, you know, particularly with regard to this export. You know, if you look at potatoes, for example, I mean, get this one for absolutely barking, is that, I think Andy mentioned that the meat industry seems to be better organised, and I'm sure it is because we have our trade body that represents potatoes, the biggest crop that we do, 5 million tonne, a hugely important crop to the UK, is the only crop where you've got, so one of the few crops you've got a mandatory levy. You have to pay a levy to AHDB potatoes. So the organisation, the trade organisation that represents us is a government organisation where you have to pay a mandatory levy. So I got onto them and I was speaking to them, and they came, in fairness to them, they came back to me straight away and they came back with some very useful information. And I said, you know, what's going to happen on this? Because we do about 2.5 million quid worth of spuds to Ireland. And I said to them, you know, what are you actually doing about it? It's great for you to tell me all the information, but what are you doing about it? The trade body, the government trade body that represents potatoes that we pay a mandatory levy to, what are you doing about it? And the response was AHDB being a non-departmental public body cannot lobby.
No.
Yeah. Yes. And that is the body that we don't have any choice. I mean, I know there's a big debate about it coming up for... coming up for a vote finally after a lot of growers got together because they've been so dissatisfied. But the body that represents the potato industry is doing no lobbying on this issue whatsoever because they are a non-departmental public body who cannot lobby. That's how barking money is.
Jack, views on that, please.
I mean, yeah, it's absolutely crazy because, you know, one of the planks of the new AHDB strategy is all about opening up export markets. Well, we could start the process by trying to avoid closing off the existing ones.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And we go on about carbon footprint. Yeah, I mean, that seems ironic to me. We've got a government who keeps reducing it from 2040, 2035, 2030, and Emily mentioned they're being more sustainable and so on. I honestly think Brexit is going to be massively increasing our carbon footprint. It's as I just said to you there, you're going to be going from day from A to B to C. Definitely, you're going to be certainly for your smaller customers, food service, it's going to be more about product coming into a centralized depot in the UK, being held and then going out again rather than product going directly. It's going to increase the carbon footprint and therefore increase the cost.
Yeah, we'll look at an example this week that was disclosed by the grocer of Minor Weir and Willis, that they had two containers of ginger coming in from overseas. It was due to come into, I think it was Felixstowe. Felixstowe is full because they've got 11,000 containers sat on the quayside full of PPE that aren't being used and there's nowhere else to put them. So that ginger's ended up in Rotterdam and they can't get it back by truck because, guys, Tim, you know better than I, it's designated as sea freight. So it's got to come back by sea and it's going to be three, four weeks late. When you think of that carbon footprint, let alone the 11,000 containers of PPE sat at Felixstowe. Andy, I'm still trying to track some positivity to this conversation for all the valid reasons that Tim is saying. Where I'm sat, stood here in Bury St Edmunds, a mile north of me, there's a £70 million glasshouse build by an amazing business called Low Carbon Farming. So that glasshouse is it's going to be the size of the O2. And unbelievably, in parallel, they built another glasshouse just on the eastern side of Norwich for the same cost. So again, I think Tim mentioned some of the figures that 80% of our salad crop is imported in. There's a lot of money being attracted into the fresh produce sector in the UK for builds such as that. And the last time I looked, low carbon farming, they were desperate to have something like 20, 30 additional sites in the UK to try and capture that market. So yeah, it does feel that there's a bit of an evolution going on, that once this has settled out and we see where the market is, there's going to be a lot more investment coming in the respect of fresh money coming in, pension fund money coming in to try and feed the nation. Joe, what's your thoughts of that with Kantar? Can you see that there's going to be an uptick of a change of dynamics of growers, that we will see more high-tech growers in the UK, and that will be beneficial to the sector?
I guess we've already got vertical farms as a sector coming in, haven't we, and challenging existing players. So there are eye-watering inflows going into that sector. You can kind of understand hypothetically what the benefits would be, but I don't think anyone has gone far enough down the road to see if that actually pays back yet. So you know, that's coming as a disruptor. I think when it comes back to you know, the price cuts and the pressure on margins, regardless of what sector this comes from, there isn't a really strong relationship from what we see in our data between prices dropping and volumes increasing. So produce, not one of those things where drop a bag of carrots half price for Christmas and the volume goes up. It doesn't. And so it kind of makes you think that's a longer term education piece to consumers about the value of fresh produce, about the value of nutrition from it. And, you know, understanding that we can't keep producing stuff as cheaply as it is and expect the same kind of nutritional quality to come through. So it's all about, you know, it's our health, it's our long-term health, and it's all the short-term decision-making around who wins biggest market share at Christmas, no doubt fueled by Kantar data being put out there to tell them whether they won or lost, that's really causing us this problem.
Andy, just coming to you, because I think it's fascinating having you on. If I could give you a magic wand, how can you fix the ills of our sector, the fresh produce sector, so that everyone can benefit from it?
Okay, interesting question, and not an easy one to answer. First of all, as an outsider looking in, the first thing is that we have to, the retailers have to be responsible. Yeah, there has to be some realization within the government of the importance of this sector and the importance of maintaining margins and viability for the business within it. So I'm sitting here thinking, on behalf of the fruit and veg, who really represents the fruit and veg sector with the retailers? Who really represents the interests of the fruit and veg with the government? I think that's part of their solution. And the other part is education. I think companies have got to realise some of the costs associated with their business. And I think the phrase that was used earlier was risk-reward. When I see the risk within this sector and the reward, meaning the margins, it begs the question how companies are even viable. So I think there has to be a re-education. I think there has to be an introduction of digital solutions. Yeah, when I look at other sectors, like the aviation sector, they've invested quite a lot in distribution, digital solutions. Everything seems to be a little more slicker, you know, de-risking. They know what the profit erosion is over a certain time. I think there has to be some heavy investment. So heavy investment in IT, heavy, you know, going to the retailer, someone representing the fruit and veg sector, someone going to the government. This is a real issue. Yeah, this is an important issue. This is a fundamental issue that needs to be addressed. And if it's not addressed, it will have long-term consequences. I want my kids, and hopefully my kids' kids, long-term, to eat good quality fruit and veg, and I want them to pay a fair price for it. And I think we have to educate, we have to invest, and we've got to, the retailers, I can say this because I have no vested interest, they've got to be accountable. They've got to be educated of the importance. And if they don't get educated, then consumer has to be educated to pay a fair price for a good product, sustainable product.
Jack, do you remember the last broadcast that we did 2 weeks ago with our healthy and sustainable food group with Barbara Bray and the rest of her team, that we talked about the Dutch diamond? So to Andy, the Dutch have got this fairly well bossed, sorted, that they have a, what they call it, a Dutch diamond. And just hold my hand, Jack, if I get it wrong, that they have very strong links with governments, with growers and tech, and they create this diamond and call it the other buzz term, the circular economy. So the Dutch horticultural fresh produce sector works in union with everyone. And this is something that Jack and I and the other members on the other broadcast debated long and hard. Tim, we might be coming to a solution. That it feels like this is the crunch hour where there has got to be a change for the likes of you and the other growers and marketeers out there. There has to be a change. Everyone, we're starting to run out of time. This has been fascinating. If I could just come to you all individually and just ask you this question. What do you see now and what do you see in the future in the respect of the fresh produce sector in Brexit in 2021 ongoing? So what do you see now? What do you see in the future? Emily, can we start with you, please?
Yeah, I see a continued interest in short supply chains and food security and how that's benefited particularly the farm stock sector and the local sector, and people really valuing food as a result of coronavirus more. And I hope we can sustain some of that long term. I think we've alluded to it a little bit already. And actually, it's nothing. It's the way the underlying rules of the market are changing, and the way that's influencing corporate and investor behavior in particular. I'm particularly interested in the green finance strategy and the stuff around the task force on climate related financial disclosures. It's technical, but it basically means that every listed business, including supermarkets, start having to disclose in their corporate reporting their impact from climate, not their impact on climate, but their impact from climate change. And that's what's creating this bias towards onshoring. If we can prove sustainability, we can prove that it's better to grow it here than it is to import it from overseas. And that's why I think this investor interest is beginning to show up in the glasshouses that you were referring to earlier.
Joe, what do you see now? What do you see in the future?
There's definitely going to be a short-term shock where we look at, you know, lots of sectors inflating, consumers aren't going to want to pay those higher prices, but fundamentally lots of fresh produce, you still need to eat it, people still need to feed themselves. I think a real tragedy will be, short-term at least, we were seeing real momentum building towards everyone getting their five a day, so like real sort of tangible health to everybody. That's only going to slide back if we have availability issues. And if prices go up, you're going to have the hardest hit, the most impoverished in our country, not able to feed themselves good, healthy, nutritious food. So, you know, in the short term and in the long term as well, the prices keep going the way they would be in short term. That's a real concern. Obviously, you have to price stuff fairly as well. So there's a caveat there too. Hopefully there's middle ground.
Joe, thank you. And if you didn't pick it up, next year is the United Nations Year of Fruit and Vegetables. So that's something that so we can hopefully all jump on to promote. Jack, what do you see now? What do you see in the future?
Very quickly, I've been doing this job for about 40 years, and that's been 40 years of barriers and challenges. We have eventually overcome them. I think the opportunities of the future are really around capitalizing on a growing interest and recognition about the importance of health and the importance of fresh fruit and fresh vegetables in the diet. And I think we really need to hang on to that, because I think the experience of the past 9 months, COVID, you know, has really underlined just how important health is and what a critical part of health diet is as well.
Jack, thank you. Tim, just before I come to your good self, I've just had a WhatsApp message from a contact who I won't name, who you and I know, and it says, give Tim a big hug. If anyone could do this, he can. Tim, what do you see now? What do you see in the future?
Male or female, Mike?
Female.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, you have to tell me who that is later.
It's your wife.
All right, it's Claire, is it? Right. Short-term, I see disruption. I mean, for the first couple of weeks, there's going to be some major disruption. We're already speaking to Spanish hauliers who are very wary about sending trucks over, particularly on the Channel ports. Hopefully it'll settle down and hopefully it'll be okay. Longer-term, it's driving more inflation into fruit and veg, definitely. There's cost to it, whether it be the cost of paperwork, which I just mentioned there, the cost of preparing the paperwork, the cost of putting it into centralised depots and moving it out again, it's driving inflation. And I fear that our customers, and particularly the supermarket sector, will just expect the packers and growers to swallow that inflation. And therefore, as Andy alluded to earlier, our already ridiculously low margins will be eroded more, which will drive more production abroad. All sounds a bit doom and gloom, but I just see that there is that extra cost, there is that inflation, and again, we're driving production abroad again.
Tim, thank you. And Andy, I think it's been fascinating having you on. I described you as the new boy. I described you as the positive joker in the pack. But actually, I think what's been really beneficial is having someone with your business perspective and cold eyes and looking at the sector, seeing fundamentally what's right with it and fundamentally what's wrong with it and telling us. So, Andy, what do you see? What do you see in the future for our sector, the fresh and produce sector, that you madly want to get involved with?
Okay, I would say the first thing I would see is the enthusiasm and the passion and knowledge within the sector. Yeah, so that's going to be part of the formula moving forward. And that's really important. Yeah, so that passion, that enthusiasm is definitely there. I do sense in the number of people I've spoken to, there's a recognition of the challenges and a willingness to work together to resolve some of those. The scary bit is when I speak to some fruit and veg importers yesterday, I said, what's going to happen on the first week of January? He said, well, I've ordered some goods and hopefully they'll turn up. And I just can't believe that anyone can run a business like that. But what I'm confident about is, and I've seen it so many times, and the fruit and veg is such an important sector, the people I speak to, the enthusiasm, the knowledge, the willingness to change, it will succeed. And all we have to do at the moment is address some of these fundamental issues. And I think those issues will be overcome. And I think the fruit and veg sector can only go from strength to strength in the future. But it's just the short term that I'm more concerned about. I would say this, it's the people I've spoken to are more fun than the meat sector. But don't tell them that.
Well, have you not met Tim before?
No, there is exceptions.
No. Everyone, I'm going to date stamp this. So it is 3:07 on Thursday, the 17th of December. We're 2 weeks before the end of the year and before Brexit happens. It'd be fascinating to get you all back on at some point, I don't know, summer of next year to see where we are at that point in time. Are you all up for that, please?
Yeah, I'm very happy.
Fantastic. So everyone, be safe. Let's see what happens. Thank you very much for participating in this. I think this has been such a fascinating broadcast for us all to be involved with. Fingers crossed, let's see what happens. It's going to be a roller coaster.
Thank you.
Well done, everyone. Thanks. Have a great Christmas. Keep safe.
Thanks, Max.
Bye.